Hello and welcome to the Humans Invent Cycling podcast. I'm Richard Moore and today I am with Lionel Burney.
Afternoon, Richard.
And Tom Southern, former professional rider.
Yes, briefly.
Now writer.
Yes, even briefer. Career as a writer so far.
Flourishing though.
It's beginning. It's getting going.
Lionel, where are we?
We are in the Sunley Pavilion, which is in the South Bank Centre, which is on the south bank of the River Thames, not far from Waterloo Station in London. It seems to be a kind of drop-in centre for the capital's freelancers, which is why it's the most appropriate place.
We are capital
place.
Freelancers.
Yeah.
Freeloaders.
Most appropriate place for us to meet.
I don't think we're supposed to be in here, actually, but we're going to carry on in here until we get thrown out.
That sounds a very nice boardroom.
We're overlooking the Thames. It's beautiful.
The Humans Invent Cycling Podcast. Interviews and analysis. We've got the big talking points covered.
Let's talk about what's happening in the world of pro cycling this week. The main race at the moment, we're looking ahead to the Vuelta, but the main race going on at the moment is the US Pro Challenge, rubbish name, in Colorado. It is a terrible name, isn't it?
It is.
Tom, have you been following the action there?
Yep, been interesting for me, mainly for the performance of Lachlan Morton, who we've seen at Lead Utah already this year, 21-year-old neo-pro. Coming up with the goods, really, for Vortis. I'd spoken to JV a little bit about him earlier in the year. And he
JV being Jonathan Vortis, of course, sorry. The director, chief executive of Garmin Sharp.
And I sort of jokingly suggested that he may be the future, which Jonathan Vortis sort of laughed off, but didn't deny. So I think it's quite interesting seeing his progress this year.
He is good at unearthing talented youngsters, isn't he?
Seems to be, yeah, and bringing them along. But I think he sort of brings along, he's got the ability to bring along people of a certain, I don't know how to put it, mental,
style of rider as well?
Yeah, well, he said in interviews before, he looks for certain things, doesn't he? Like certain physical attributes that are going to allow a rider to succeed in a professional rank. So he obviously goes for a certain type of rider and then finds them and then works out how best to bring them through, which he sort of does well, but no one's really kind of, become a Tour de France contender, say, yet.
Although Talansky might be that, given his debut this year. What kind of rider is Lachlan, then?
Out and out climber, pretty much, really. I mean, he's a tiny guy, very skinny, to the point where I'd met him when he was sort of 16 or 17, and he was a little guy. And I saw him at Tour of Britain last year, and I was actually surprised how someone that little could make a bicycle go so fast, but he obviously does.
You've been following Colorado at all?
Yeah, I was going to just make a comment about about Lachlan Morton's moustache. He's sporting a moustache, a young man with a moustache. He's 22, 21, and he's grown a moustache. I mean, this is peculiar.
Well, we covered this at the Tour. I think I said at the end of the Tour that there was no place for moustaches in the peloton.
Clearly
shaved legs and moustaches. I'd say Tom is sporting an incredible beard. You look
virile,
like,
Rich.
Well, you do look virile. You always look virile. But you also look a little bit, you look like you might be distantly related to Brian Holm.
Well, I was inspired by
We've all been inspired by Brian Holm.
Urs Fröhler, Rich.
Urs Fröhler, wow, that's going back a bit.
He had a good moustache.
You're too young to remember Urs Fröhler, are you not?
Must have seen photos in a book or something.
And who's the other guy? The Pole?
Lech Piasecki. We talked about him last week, actually. Let's move on from Colorado and the awfully named
moustaches.
Leg race and moustaches. Let's definitely move on from moustaches. Although a little word for Josh Edmondson's been riding well there as well. Another young rider, Josh Edmondson of Team Sky.
The seventh.
He's been riding well.
Yesterday, yeah, I think.
And very aggressively as well. We're talking here on the eve of the Vuelta, so it may well be underway by the time you listen to this. And the action starts more or less immediately. A very, very mountainous race. There's a hilly stage on Sunday, day two. But let's look ahead to that a little bit and which kind of riders we fancy for the overall. It could go to the wire because the Angleroo is the day to go. So it's the course is very, very tough right to the end. A lot of strong climbers in the field. It's actually a very open race. There's a lot of riders who could win it. You know, you've got Nibali. You've got Valverde, Rodriguez, Henao, I think, has got a good shout. Lionel, who do you think is going to win it?
Well, I think Vincenzo Nibali will win the Vuelta, yeah.
That's very very assertive.
I just think
he will win the Vuelta.
He's the strongest climber.
Do you think so?
I think he is, yeah. The way he won the Giro convincingly without really having to see off a concerted challenge from anyone else. He's had a nice break. He wants to target the World Championships in his home country shortly after the Vuelta. So I think it's ideal for him, you know, to ride strongly through a three-week race. I don't see him necessarily using it as purely as preparation for the Worlds. I think the best preparation would be to give it everything he's got, try and win it, and then turn up at...
He's been very quiet since the Giro. Rode Poland. He could be going into it a little bit undercooked as a general feeling, but that might be an advantage.
Problem is that the mountain stages start so early, don't they? I think there's a sort of a major mountain stage and a medium mountain stage in the first 4 days, and so the kind of the overall pattern for the race is going to get set very early. And I think, as we said in the last podcast, the problem with the Grand Tours when they have, you know, I think there's 12 mountain stages. In a three-week race, the problem is that the pattern gets set. The strongest riders come to the surface early on, and then really that pattern just repeats itself. So if somebody is the best climber in the race, they will just, you know, gradually stretch their advantage out day by day, unless they have some kind of either an illness, crash, or just a terrible day. So I think we'll see a bit like last year's Vuelta, where the four main contenders were pretty obvious early on, and then they just fought it out amongst themselves. I anticipate it being perhaps maybe four or five people will establish themselves early on. Nibali will be one of them, simply because of his ability. Whether he's undercooked or not, he will have an opportunity to ride himself into the race. And then in the back half, when the mountain stages are particularly hard and become more decisive, I think he'll be heated up good and proper.
As I said earlier, the Angliru is the day to go, one day to go. So, you know, the idea obviously is that the race comes down to that mountain, but previous history tells us that might not be the case. It may well be Cyberden. It is a hell of a mountain, though. It was probably the decisive mountain in 2011, wasn't it, when Kobo went on and won the race, won that stage, I think, didn't he, and then went on to win the race overall. Tom, do you think somebody else will win the Vuelta?
I think Valverde will have a crack at it, personally. He was obviously in great shape for the Tour, and his mechanical problem couldn't have been at a worse time at all, which then kind of allowed him to ride a different race, so he wouldn't have expended as much as other guys who were completely spent after the Tour. And Movistar as a team have been so strong this year in all of the Grand Tours, it seems like they'll be keen to reap their rewards, really. I mean, sort of up there with Sky in the Tour, they were one of the other big team. And I think, you know, in their home race, they'll want him to do it. I don't know, I can't see quite how he would do it as much as I think he could do it. Whereas a guy like Rodriguez, I suppose you can see, he's going to at least summit finishes on Nibali as well. Because Valverde is a bit more consistent, but
he's won it twice before, hasn't he? The Vuelta
once, I thought.
Once or
I don't
twice.
Know. History's so murky.
We're not doing very well here.
The problem is with the Vuelta.
I could look this up.
The number of sort of Vuelta winners in the past that either are or aren't the champion. Heras, you know, he won. Roberto Heras won three or possibly two. Menchov won a Vuelta that he didn't actually win because he was given it after Heras tested positive. With the help of Wikipedia there, Rich, I'm sure
Valverde,
you can find
Valverde
out.
Has only won it once. Did he win it another time and had it stripped when he was done for doping?
No, I don't think so. No, that would be Contador, you may be thinking of.
Okay.
Who's won twice as many Grand Tours.
You're right, the Vuelta over all the other races perhaps has a pretty murky history. I think Inao is worth a shout. You know, he rode the Giro, but he wasn't sort of challenging for the overall there, and he's backed by a very, very strong Sky team. I think it's actually a stronger team than went to the Tour this year. If you look at the guys who are riding, Dario Cataldo, Kirienka, Christian Kniez, Salvatore Puccio, Luke Rowe, Zandio as well. Very strong team, I think. And you know, that could be a factor. Who knows? Ultimately, it'll come down to whether Henao, I don't know if I see him as a Grand Tour winner or not, but he's clearly the leader of that team. I think he is the leader over Uran, and he's backed by a very strong team there. You mentioned Rodriguez. Rodriguez is 34 now. Time is running out for him to win a Grand Tour. He's been pretty close. And I just wonder, I mean, he got better at the Tour as it went on, but I think he came out of it very, very tired. He's admitted that he came out of it very, very tired. And I think it'll be tough for anyone who's ridden the Tour to double up at the Vuelta.
This is the Humans Invent Cycling Podcast with Richard Moore and Lionel Burney.
I think another thing we should mention is the demise of the Euskaltel team. This will be their last Grand Tour, a team that's been around since 1994, and a real fixture of, certainly the Vuelta, the Tour de France, and any time the race is in the Pyrenees and the Basque region, with the hordes of local fans out in their orange kit. That will be really missed, and that team will be missed. It's a sad day when they pack up. I think they've announced quite early on, you know, while the season's still in full swing, that they're packing up at the end of the year, and I wonder if there was a sort of bit of bluffery going on there, that they're, you know, still holding out for somebody to come forward.
Possibly. I mean, the issue with the Euskaltel team is that they hold this World Tour licence, which obviously has a value, but the team's identity is so wrapped up in the Basque country, sponsored by a Basque telephone company and by the Basque kind of tourist. The Euskadi is basically the Basque region designed to promote the Basque country to the rest of Europe and the world. So the team has got this very central identity, and in fact they only hire Basque riders. They're a bit like Athletic Bilbao, the football team, in that sense. So back in, you know, until about the mid-90s, they only hired Basque footballers. And whilst that is a, you know, gives them a tremendous sense of kind of not even national identity, it's regional identity.
Local, yeah.
It makes it harder for the people that are trying to go out and get another sponsor to, you know, they already have such a strong, unique selling point. So, you know, what are they offering to another company to come in? Would they remain a Basque team, or would they become a general Spanish team? The fact that they're going is sad because they've been around for so long, but I think it's also a sign of the Spanish economy more than anything.
And as you say, cycling increasingly is becoming a global sport, and selling such a local team in a global marketplace, to use a horrible expression, it must be difficult. Tom, any thoughts on Euskaltel?
Yeah, I mean, sort of sad to see them go, but they've kind of had a few troubles before. They've always been sort of one of the lower budget teams that kind of kicks along at that level. But they, you know, they never really seem to succeed on a major, major level, like tour stage wins here, there, or a Giro stage win, or a couple of Giro stage wins, which was obviously great, and it was huge if you look at it in terms of them being a regional team. But then again, in a kind of global marketplace, to use your terminology, which is hard to see how they could survive.
They're always visible. Partly that's the orange outfits, yeah. But also they always have riders that are up there, and they had riders up there. Mikel Nieve was very good at the Tour this year, but not quite good enough to win a stage or to even finish in the top 10. They've also got a bit of a checkered history with regards to doping. They're not one of those teams who you would say, yes, they've been at the forefront of the fight against doping, would you?
No.
I mean, they've got, you know, riders who've tested positive. Ivan Mayo, after he left the team, tested positive. Mikel Astorloza, after he won a stage of the Tour, tested positive. Their doctor, Jesus Lola, Loza, who was helping David Miller with his drugs habit prior to Miller's bust in 2004, Miller kind of named him as having helped him. So this does put a bit of a shadow or a cloud over the team, doesn't it? It's never been, as I say, a team that you would say they've done their bit.
No, I think they're old school, aren't they? In a sense, you know, they kind of belong to that era of sort of Once and Kelme. They know, you know, they've just lasted.
You're not
longer,
saying that Once and Kelme were involved in all that.
We'd have to get that run by the lawyers before I'm prepared to say that. But
shattering dreams, Lionel, left, right, and
just
centre.
Another point on them, as Tom says, the problem of them being a very much a sort of local team, really. it's always a bit farcical when they turned up at the Tour of Flanders or Paris-Roubaix with a minimum six riders, and you just sort of thought, well, who's actually winning out of this arrangement that obliges all the World Tour teams to put a squad in every single race on the World Tour? And I wondered whether it might not have been a bad idea at some point in the last two or three years to kind of go down the Cofidis route of dropping down to European level, Europe car route, sorry, going down to the European Tour level, because they wouldn't really have lost out anything if they'd done that, and they would have saved a lot of money.
On that kind of point, you're going to get more and more teams doing that now, where I think you'll get more of a separation between the World Tour, the big teams, the big budget teams, where the money's coming from international kind of sponsors. So you look at Jean-René Bernardo, he tried to run a sort of regional-ish French team. France Desir du, Madio, sort of borderline xenophobe. And those teams will all sort of are naturally going to kind of drop down now, I think, and they'll have their own sort of Pro Conti level, which will all be those sort of formerly big but now just sort of mid-budget teams, whereas, you know, Garmin Sharps, your Skies of the world will separate themselves further and further.
I think they're looking at, as you made the point, Richard, about Sky's roster for the Vuelta being very strong, stronger than quite a lot of other teams, tour teams, really.
Stronger than their own tour team.
Possibly stronger than their own tour team, yeah. But without labouring the sort of football analogy, in the Premier League era in English football, the big five or six teams are able to have these huge squads of 25 or 30 really top-level players. That progression is being mirrored by cycling in a way. So, as you say, Garmin Sharp, Sky will recruit riders from an international base, and they will end up with stronger rosters than some of these teams that have much more of a national identity. And it's a big problem. You can see the next kind of problem looming for kind of the Italian teams. I mean, Lamprey are already quite a long way down the road that Cofidis and Euskaltel have already trod. If Cannondale hadn't, you know, they were Liquigas, but they now seem to have flipped from being that kind of Italian team into being much more of an international team by having an American sponsor and having sort of Sagan as the
leader.
superstar leader. So, you're absolutely right, Tom, that it seems like there's a bit of a divide happening at the moment. Mm. And the big teams, you know, you look at the way that in Belgium, Omega Pharma have gone more the Sky Garmin Sharp route, and Lotto Bellisol are still kind of, you know, they're sort of sinking down, they're becoming a bit Aston Villa or Norwich City.
You're listening to the Humans Invent Cycling Podcast, powered by Sharp.
So we were talking a little bit about Spanish cycling there, and on that note, I went out to Chelmsford in Essex today to see Alex Dowsett, who rides for Movistar, and chat a little bit to him about his season so far and his goals for the rest of the year.
I'm off to Germany this weekend for Vattenfall Classics, then Poitou-Charentes, which I'm really excited about because that's where I got my first pro victory back in 2011. And then after that, GP Plouay, and then back home for a fortnight Tour of Britain. It's not confirmed yet, but hopefully World Championships. And after that, having the foggiest.
You haven't been training, racing that much since the Giro. I think 5 days racing or so, you said?
Yeah, 5 days, not including a little bit of Eneco I did. But I've been training hard, so...
Maybe you can clarify exactly what happened at Eneco. You didn't dislocate both your thumbs, as reported.
No, I'm not quite sure how the crash happened. I had everything under control, and then next thing I know, I'm on the floor. I'm pretty sure I hit my head, so I don't actually remember how it happened, but... piecing it together and the injuries I got, I reckon we were avoiding some Rona furniture and someone just turned left into me. I got up, tried to carry on, but just couldn't hold on to my handlebars. I damaged one thumb, and the other hand went through a rear wheel, which was unpleasant. It wasn't the best, which was pretty disappointing, but it's bike racing.
Obviously, your big goals are based around time trials, with the Tour of Britain time trial and the World Championship time trial, hopefully. So is your training being geared towards that?
Yeah, there's been a lot of time on my TT bike, pretty much. Yeah, I haven't done many long rides. It's been a bit more intensity than usual. It's all geared around the time trial, but then so is my whole career's been geared around the time trial.
So you're coming towards the end of your first season with Movistar. How would you sum up that year, and how has the move worked out for you?
it's been amazing. It's not as different to Team Sky as what I thought it was going to be. Team Sky a bit more clinical, Movie Star a bit more, it's like a family kind of atmosphere. I think, you know, there's something to be said for both. Thoroughly enjoying things. The Spanish is coming along nicely. I've had loads of opportunities, and you know, obviously the Giro is a massive highlight for me, and it was sort of a relief. It was really nice to be able to pay them back for all the faith they've had in me.
It's a long-established team, one of the oldest teams in professional cycling in various different guises. Still a lot of those guys, you know, who were running the team in the 80s, 90s, still involved from the injuring years, the Delgado years. But it's a team that seems to have made huge strides this year, and they animated the Tour de France. Obviously, Nairo Quintana was second. And they seem to have really changed the way they approach the sport. Has that been a surprise to you? Can you tell us a little bit about, you know, your work with the coaching staff, the sports science staff there?
I think, and this is across the board from all teams now, with the way cycling's going, the gains that would have been found in unethical ways back in the past are now having to be found through, you know, sports science, nutrition and all that. And I think every team now is taking that on. You know, Movistar have employed a sports science department, have taken a much more scientific approach to training, nutrition and everything. You know, there's still some of the old what's the best way, habits, sort of quirky little things that sort of remain. Like, you know, we eat dinner at 8-9 o'clock at night, as opposed to sort of a British 7 o'clock.
Am I right in thinking that say Dave Brailsford at Team Sky would arrange dinner according to, you know, it's not so much a tradition that you all sit down together, you sit down according to when you have your massage and so on. It's performance influence, it's performance led.
Yeah.
And is it still the case at Movistar that perhaps some of those, particularly Spanish traditions, prevail?
Yeah, definitely. Also, the Spanish guys don't think they get hungry till about 10 o'clock at night either. So I'm sitting there clutching my stomach and, you know, they sort of ambling down. And
yeah, it's just tapas.
Yeah. No, but it's been really good fun. I'm picking up the lingo fairly quickly as well, so I'm thoroughly enjoying it and looking forward to the rest of this season, the beginning of next as well.
Any plans to live in Spain, or are you going to carry on being based here in Essex?
For sure, going to be based here. I need to relook at my winter if we're in for another bad one, because last year I had a couple of injuries in the winter, but did get caught out with the weather a couple of times. So I think whilst I still want to remain an Essex boy, I think I will have to get myself abroad for a bit more training in the winter. You know, that was something Sky did very well, and something I maybe took for granted this winter. So that's, get myself Mallorca, Alicante, south of Spain. I think I'll be spending a lot of time there this winter.
Coming from Sky and the British setup, although you've been involved in other setups as well, did you find, you know, moving to Movistar, that the team were keen to pick your brains and to learn about what Sky were doing?
Yeah, I mean, a fair bit, but to be honest, with my time at Sky, I was very much in the B team, so we were not left to our own devices, but we didn't see so much of the altitude stuff that the tour team saw, so I didn't actually see a huge amount of what Sky were doing, so I wasn't of much use to Movistar in that respect. But when I felt that there was something to be gained, I will try and help out. But I think what I realised pretty quick, that Movistar have a way of doing things that has been successful, and you know, showed this year, still successful. The way they approached the team time trial in Terreno was different to what I've been used to. I thought it was an utter shambles, but we ran second. So it's been a real learning experience for me.
Is that par for the course? Because obviously the Giro, you were second as well. Good team time trial there.
Yeah.
Is that just the way that they approach it?
I think so. I think there's definitely something in that. So I think I went into there thinking that I was going to know everything and do things my own way. But I realised pretty quick that the way they've been doing things and continue to do is successful as well. So I think I've taken the best of both.
Next year, of course, Tour de France starts in the UK, starts in Yorkshire, comes through Essex as well.
Yeah.
Is that something you've spoken to your team about already?
Yeah, that's sort of the long-term plan, I think. I mean, nothing's set in stone. Just because it starts in England isn't going to get me a free ticket into the tour. I'm going to have to earn my place. You know, there's 25 guys that all want to be there. But yeah, that's the plan, is to be there. Yeah, it'd be a dream come true to do the tour in my home country.
Before that, the real tour, the Tour of Britain, got Nairo Quintana riding that as well, which is a real coup for the race. And you know, second in the Tour de France revelation there. Can you tell us a little bit, just finally, about Nairo Quintana? Were you surprised by his performance at the Tour, and what's he like?
I wasn't massively surprised, basically, because if we look at... I did Tour de l'Avenir back in 2010, and Nairo won it then, and it was him and Talansky that were fighting it out for the win. And then we see this year, you know, it was again him and Talansky and a bit of Kwiatkowski as well, fighting it out for the young jersey and all up there. So it is a natural progression, which is really nice to see. It was great to see him up there as well. You know, and Rui Costa as well, winning them two stages. He's one of the friendliest guys. He barely speaks a word of English, but you just tell he's friendly. He's always a smile on his face, and he's a real fighter as well. So it was great. I mean, it's always hard to watch a race you want to be a part of, but it was good to see them do well. Yeah, I was really happy for Froome as well and Team Sky. Yeah. Growing up with Stannard and Pete, I did a lot of racing with Froome, so it was nice to see them doing so well as well.
The Cycling Podcast with humansinvent.com. Innovation, craftsmanship and design.
So that was Alex Dowsett that we heard from there in his local bike shop in Chelmsford, which serves very nice coffee, actually, recommended. Wish I could remember the name of the bike shop now. I'm going to look that up on Wikipedia as well in a minute. One thing that he mentioned, actually, when we weren't doing the interview for the podcast, was that he is riding the Tour of Britain, obviously, as he mentioned, but he also isn't down to ride the team time trial for Movistar, which clashes with the final day of the Tour of Britain.
That's the World Championship team time trial.
World Championship team time trial, yeah, in Florence. And he said he's got permission to leave the Tour of Britain early to go and ride the team time trial. But there's a time trial, obviously, which he's targeting at the Tour of Britain on the Tuesday, which is right up his street, which he could win, which could put him in the yellow jersey. And I said, if you're in the yellow jersey at the Tour of Britain, what will you do? And he paused and thought, said that would be a question for the management to answer. But it's an interesting, that'll be an interesting scenario for them, because they definitely fancy the team time trial. They've really been a strong team time trial outfit this year, Movistar. They'll really fancy that, and they'll also want Alex Dowsett in their team. So that's an interesting potential scenario to look out for. I think he'd like to win the Tour of Britain as well. Tom, not only a former rider and now writer, but also the co-author, is that what you're calling yourself?
Yes.
Co-author of one of the year's best books, which I recommended on last week's podcast, Domestique by Charlie Wigelius in Small Writing and Tom Southam.
Inside various colours.
So Tom, you typed it up for him. Added, you know, helped him punctuate it.
Well, no, my punctuation was atrocious.
Right, I can imagine. But to explain to people, yeah, it's probably more of a collaborative effort. I mean, obviously, a writer will collaborate with an athlete to ghostwrite their book, and it is a genuinely collaborative effort. But in this case, it was probably more collaborative than most, because you rode with Charlie on several occasions.
Yes.
What was that experience like for you?
It was quite strange at first. I mean, the first kind of thing we had to get over was basically I was going to Charlie with sort of, you know, questions, and we'd sit down and we'd talk and we'd discuss, and I'd come back with the transcript. And then I would kind of work that into something. I mean, the hardest part was going back to him and presenting stuff to him, because I mean, I know Charlie so well. There was a lot of times when I had to sort of bridge gaps or know what he was thinking. And I think that was quite a strange experience for him to read back what he had been thinking but hadn't said.
Right.
A lot of the time. And so to start with, presenting it to him was always a bit strange. But we got into the swing of it, and it was quite a collaborative process. I think it was unique in that respect, because we did have history together, and some of the events we were actually together, and I was there at the time.
Presumably from the get-go, you were very clear about what kind of book Charlie wanted to write, because it's a book about the grittier end of professional cycling. He was he made a career as a domestique, yeah, as the title suggests. So it's a book full of stories about being a journeyman professional in a way, and what you get a real sense of reading it is this constant fear, anxiety, insecurity about where the next contract was coming from, whether there'd be another contract. I guess you were on the same page, as it were, with that.
Yeah, I mean,
trying to write that sort of book.
When it had come up originally, because I kind of thought I wanted to write that kind of book, but my experience in the peloton was quite limited. Even though I understood how it had been and I'd lived like that, so I had the idea and I had the kind of the vision for it, and then at the same time Charlie had the same thing, and Charlie also had this like wealth of experience, and he had so many stories, and he had so much. It really kind of qualified the story much more than I could tell it on my own. So we were kind of chatting, and it came up that he was thinking of doing it, and we basically had the same kind of idea. That was, for both of us, even though I was only there in Italy for 3 years, that kind of, like you said, that fear of, what's going to come, what's going to be next, and the real insecurity of it, which I think is less and less apparent sort of in the peloton now. That was a big thing, and that was a story we wanted to tell. When we started it, we kind of thought it's going to be the domestique story. Then I think while we were working on it, we both kind of thought it's more of a document of how it was, because I think things have changed, certainly for an English-speaking rider now. Things are very different in terms of, if you're a neo-pro now, there's a good chance you'll know Mark Cavendish, who's been world champion. And so in the peloton, you've got that kind of, you've got immediate, you've got friends, you've got respect, you've got basic.
Whereas Charlie, I mean, that comes through very strongly. He was a real outsider when he was breaking into that world.
Absolutely.
Which made it much harder, obviously.
And I mean, he was even more so than me, because he was generation before me, where I was funded from 18 onwards, sort of world class. So that was coming into existence, where Charlie went and he did the original, got no money, living in sort of this, that and the other. So he had it even more so, but he's almost kind of the last rider of that generation.
He is,
generation.
Probably. Him and, David Miller, I guess, but Miller was just before him, so wasn't he? So Charlie was...
Dave's story is fairly exceptional in itself. There's not many people who are ever amateur for 1 year and win bags of races. So that was another reason we thought it would be interesting, would be because most people's experience isn't Cav's experience or Dave's experience or the experience of a winner. It's more, sort of Charlie's experience, or a guy who would also be interesting would be Steve Cummings, surely, who's had a sort of a much, I say better, but a more successful sort of wins-wise career than Charlie, but quite a similar sort of thing.
Yeah. When I put on Twitter that you were joining us for the podcast, we had a couple of questions. Asked Tom Sutherland when his book's coming out. He did a great job of Charlie's. That was Spooky Dokey Blog.
Yeah.
But I guess, are you saying that your book was Charlie's book?
I think so. I think we both sort of see it that way, whereby it kind of was that collaborative thing.
Robert Lunn asked, were there any interesting tales or stories that didn't make it into Domestique?
Many, many. But, I mean, the trouble is, when you sit down, you actually look at what you can put into a book with the libel laws as they are. So many stories that...
I think those libel laws apply to podcasts, do they? So...
I think they do it. Yeah, I'm afraid they do. Sorry to pour water on that.
Yeah, none that I can repeat anyway.
I want to get onto this question. Chris Dykes asked, what's up with the World Championships? Will it ever switch away from national teams to pro? It doesn't make any sense. Race one way all year and then switch it. Now that wasn't directed at you, that question, but it is relevant, because one of the major episodes in Charlie's book was an episode that involved you as well, where 2005 World Championships in Madrid.
Yes, correct.
You were riding for Great Britain.
That's correct.
You were riding for Great Britain. And you were also riding for Italy, Tom.
No, allegedly.
Allegedly, sorry. No, well, Charlie tells us the full inside story of what happened. Maybe, but...
I wouldn't put it as well for Italy.
No?
I'd put it as riding for your profession.
Yeah.
As opposed to your country is how I'd see it. But it's a complicated race that says it's, if you have a race that's run on national teams, how is it then fair that the winner gets the rainbow jersey, and that rainbow jersey is then a prize for a trade team? it doesn't really make much sense unless there is a system in place that rewards the people who are doing their day's work, which at the time there wasn't, and there now is.
It was also a time of transition for British cycling where, you know, this was the way that riders had probably ridden for Great Britain in the past and for lots of other minor countries.
Well, there's heaps of examples.
Well, dare I say it, but the Olympic Games last year in London, where there was a small British team, 5 riders, wasn't it, were helping Cavendish. There were very obviously other riders helping Cavendish who were not riding for Great Britain and who rode for other nationalities. That was an interesting scenario in light of what happened to you and Charlie in 2005. Just to put people fully in the picture of what happened, following the race, Charlie and Tom were accused of having not been riding for Great Britain, but riding instead to help the Italian team. Both of them were based in Italy at the time, riding for Italian teams. And they were banned for life from riding for Great Britain, although I think you did ride for Great Britain again, didn't you?
Yes.
So that was rescinded.
Yes, mine was. Charlie's wasn't.
Charlie's wasn't.
I mean, he wasn't selected. Perhaps he wasn't banned for life. It's not actually official, but I think, in a way, GB made a rod for their own back, because I don't think they even knew what was going to happen in the future. And now that they've had a sprinter, you know, they had the London Olympics, and there was no doubt there were other people that were riding. You know, I spoke to a member of a professional team on the evening of the race, and he said, well, 100% I was riding for my professional team. Why wouldn't I? And when I said to him, Mark, like, Charlie and I were banned from the national team for life for that, he was utterly shocked, because that's the way it's always worked. But the problem was, it was kind of this odd crossover where, you know, Great Britain was trying to establish itself, and it was trying to say, this isn't the way we're going to do things, which was absolutely fair. It also, they had just employed Max Chiandri, who was Italian, and it didn't help that blah blah blah.
There was a suspicion, perhaps, or a paranoia, if you like, that there would be suspicion. There was some link.
Even in Rob's book, Rob Hale's book, he talks about riding for Cav at the
2006 Commonwealth Games.
Yeah, absolutely. Which is
as instructed to do so by the English team.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And Cav was riding for an Isle of Man.
Just from an outsider's perspective, because I had to cover that story at the time, and it was something that basically directly led to John Herity lose his job as National Road coach, which, you know, really, to lose a man of John's experience.
And John understood.
He knew,
even if he didn't endorse it, if he didn't give his official approval, he knew.
Well, he knows the world of professional cycling, and he knew, given the situation that Tom and Charlie were in, that he had no real cards to play in terms of saying, on the eve of the race, you cannot do that, because what's he going to, you know, what has he got to offer? From what I gathered at the time was, the real problem was that British cycling obviously was funded by the National Lottery, public money, and the real issue was that people at you know, UK Sport, or whoever it was at the time, it may have been the predecessors of UK Sport, whoever was funding British cycling, people who understood cycling, and there was only sort of Peter Keane and maybe one or two other people watching that race, were thinking, hang on a minute, what are two British riders doing on the front of the peloton for 2 or 3 laps or whatever it was, when people knew that the game plan was to try and set up Roger Hammond for a sprint finish. And so it really wasn't a case of, it was a case of kind of not being able to kind of justify what the tactic was, given that the tactic had already been publicly stated that everything was going to be for Roger Hammond in that race. So really it was an unfortunate situation, I think, and it came to a head simply because, my personal belief is simply because Peter Keane was watching on TV and wondering, you know, why this was happening.
Peter Keane was, I mean, he was at the time moving aside, wasn't he? Was he even involved? Had he already gone to UK Sport that time?
Yeah,
I think?
But UK Sport.
Well, exactly.
One of the key funders.
So he had gone to UK Sport. Dave Brailsford was in charge, and I think keen to send out a message. Going back briefly to 2006 and that Commonwealth Games, you know, that couldn't even have been said to be in the national interest when Rob Hales helped Mark Cavendish win the scratch race in the Commonwealth Games, because one of the riders he beat was James McCallum, who rides for Rafa now. And, you know, a Scottish rider, all part of the Great Britain umbrella, if you like, but Rob Hales riding for England helped Mark Cavendish riding for the Isle of Man, certainly against the spirit of the...
Well, he was after the race disqualified by the commissaire.
Yeah, Mark Tarrant, I think. Cavendish should have been disqualified, potentially.
Yeah, I mean...
That's always a tricky one.
To answer the original question, that's... Yeah, it really should change.
How did you feel watching the Olympic road race and watching the likes of Bleep?
I actually watched it with Charlie. He happened to be in my house, and it's kind of... It didn't bother me, because what was different wasn't what they were doing there and then. I expected them to ride that way. You would ride that way as a professional. Mm. What was unusual was the punishment that, not so much me, but Charlie got. I don't know whether that's a personal thing between certain people and Charlie. It might be that, you know, people don't like Charlie or there's some other history.
There was talk of Charlie even going Team Sky before he retired, wasn't there?
Yes.
So the door hadn't apparently been closed completely.
I don't know about that. No. It went a long way down the garden path, so to speak, and then suddenly...
So to speak.
Isn't the problem, though, that going back to the listener's question, you have all year, you have these trade team alliances, and not only that, but in any race, you've got riders from different teams working together for a common interest. Mm. Even though they ride for different teams, otherwise you wouldn't have bike racing. You know, in any break, there has to be collaboration.
It's always going
to
be.
And then there has to be that trade-off, that deal.
If the
bunch is chasing behind, one team will say, Omega Pharma will say, well, we'll put three on the front if you put three on the front. And so there's all these deals going on the whole time. But then when it comes down to something, you know, who's making up their mind? Where does the line get drawn? That this is collaboration that's acceptable and this is collaboration that's unacceptable.
I think it's got to come down to money, which puts me in the, you know, it makes what I did wrong. But if
how much did you get?
Same as Charlie, but
it's your round then.
Well, no, you haven't bought me a drink yet.
Okay,
but I think you know, if it's got to come down to a point of going, okay, there is collaboration is going to happen, but if people are paying from outside a race to somebody else, then surely you're breaking the rules.
Did Rigoberto Urán get the briefing notes before the Olympic road race, I wonder?
I don't know.
On that note, we'll maybe move on to the next section.
The Humans Invent Cycling Podcast. For more articles, go to humansinvent.com/cycling.
Humans Invent Cycling Podcast. I'm with Tom Southam and Lionel Burney and Richard Moore. And the cycle shop that I met Alex Dowsett in earlier was Athlon Sport, which I thought I should mention. I looked them up. They were good coffee. So we'll just finish off here with some questions that we were asked. Let's start with this one. Stephen Perryman, is Rio 2016 now realistic for Cavendish with no Madison or points race and Wiggle going for the team pursuit too? Linked to that, Ian Miller asks, can Mark Cavendish make the Rio squad on the track? Now, it's been announced this week that Mark Cavendish is riding in Ghent in September, and with a view to perhaps riding the World Cup in Manchester in November. He said at the Olympics last year that he fancied going for the team pursuit in Rio. Perhaps also the Omnium could be an event that suits him, and that's still in the Olympic programme for 2016. It's not simply the case, though, that he'd be able to parachute in for the team pursuit. Same with Wiggins. Now you've got to ride World Cups to qualify. Individuals have to ride rather than just teams. So Cavendish and Wiggins, and I think it's perhaps easier for Wiggins because he's now said, since our last podcast, that he will race on the road next year and then stop riding on the road and dedicate all his efforts to the track to go for the team pursuit in Rio. But Mark Cavendish, it's going to be more difficult for him, is it not?
Well, I'm not sure about the team pursuit necessarily, but I think he's made for the Omnium. I mean, I think had the qualification rules with London 2012, the only reason he couldn't ride the Omnium, I think, was because he hadn't ridden an international Omnium in order to score individual points to earn a play the right to be selected. So this is a real early marker. 2013, long way to go to Rio, an early marker that. Don't close the door on your track hopes by not competing. You know, go and ride some events, score some points, and give himself as many options as possible coming up to Olympic year in 2016. But the Omnium, I would have thought, is a no-brainer. The bunch events hold no fear for him. The Kilo,
the flying lap and the kilo presumably would hold no fear for him, and an individual pursuit, he can knock out a time good enough to put him far enough up the leaderboard against the other riders that are likely to do that. I think he's got a good chance.
Yeah, and I think team pursuit as well. I mean, he's always a brilliant team time trialist. He's got the speed. I think there's no reason why he couldn't ride the team pursuit as well, which would be an interesting circle for him to complete, having been, you know, fallen foul of British Cycling and Simon Jones all those years ago over their insistence that he ride the team pursuit. He hated that at the time, but it's certainly an event that he, you know, increasingly team pursuers have got speed, and he certainly got speed.
I mean, it's almost like Team GB have got an embarrassment of riches when you've got a guy like Cav who wants to make it into a team, and he's not in any way guaranteed to go straight into it, like you said. I mean, if he was going to do the Omni, you're going to knock out Ed Clancy, who is pretty exceptional himself. It's.
I've actually said, you know, watching Laura Trott in the Omnium, and she's made that event her own, it's like watching Mark Cavendish, you know, and he would probably ride it in a similar kind of way. I think they're quite similar athletes in a way. Both brilliant racers, both got great turn of speed, and yeah, you're absolutely right. That could be that could be made for him.
I think the Olympics and Cav, it's a complicated. There's a lot of history there. You know, 2008, he pulled out of the Tour de France in order to ride the Madison at the Olympics, and Bradley Wiggins had already ridden the individual and the team pursuit and was on his knees, and Cav missed out on a medal. And I think he was the only member of the track squad not to get a medal in Beijing. And of course, 2012, everything was set up for Mark Cavendish to win the road race on the opening day of competition, and it didn't quite happen. And then, of course, the following day, Lizzie Armitstead got a silver in the women's road race. And so I think there's a, you know, where people often say, well, what more can Mark Cavendish do other than, you know, win, you know, overtake Eddie Merckx's Tour de France stage win record? I think that an Olympic medal and an Olympic gold medal is something that you know, he would really want to get before the end of his career.
Yeah. When you've been as successful as he has and you're as driven as he has, you have to have some sort of target, like you said, and there has to be something. You know, he's won the world, he's won Milan San Remo, he's won tour stages, world stages, his umpteen victories on the road. He has to have something that is going to make him go out and train in all the crap weather and, you know, really push himself and keep pushing himself.
I just wonder, he's already raced more days this year than any other professional, and really? Extending his season into the winter, he can't just go to the World Cup and not ride hard, not be in condition to ride hard. So that's a little bit of an ask, although the way that guys are training now, they do tend to be doing more intensive training in the winter as well. It's not about sort of building an endurance base anymore, is it?
I think he's come through the Rod Ellingworth school of having a minimum level of fitness 12 months a year.
Yeah.
And I think one of the frustrations Rod had when Cavendish first became the superstar was that his downtimes were bigger, you know, longer, and his kind of, you know, his decline in form and fitness was kind of deeper than it had been before.
Yeah, he needs a lot of training.
And so, yeah, I think as Tom says, you know, this keeps him focused and on track for the next three winters, not just this one, but the two.
And we've always talked about the danger of Cavendish running out of goals. This could be the thing. Quick question, Spooky Doki blog again. Can we have more of Lionel's stories about making pros drink beer during stage races? Don't know if we've got time for that. There are so many stories.
I can't think of any other.
While you're having a wee think about that, Lionel, Spond asks, what's the hardest day race or stage you've seen or ridden? Tom, what's the hardest day you've ever had on a bike?
Hardest day I ever had on a bike was the
2005 Worlds.
No, the 2004 Giro del Trentino, which I remember at one stage going through the feed zone at over 60k an hour with Seiko on the front. It was the year that Kunigo won everything.
Were you still able to grab your musette?
I grabbed my musette and I threw it over my shoulder, and it took me 15 kilometres before I could take out the food that was in it. I think like the last three wheels, and there must have been no climbers whatsoever in the race, because every time we hit the climbs, I looked behind me and there'd be no one. And this one day, I remember getting to the climb, it was quite early, so I didn't want to be dropped. And looking behind, there was one guy. I was like, okay, as long as he's there, then I'm not going to be first to be dropped, it's okay. I was hanging on, I'm looking back, and he was there, and then eventually I looked back again, and he just said, sorry, mate, stopped and got off his bike by the side of the road, and I was like, oh. So, yeah, dropped there after about 40 kilometres, and just a whole nasty day.
Did you finish?
Yep, I finished, I think, second last. It was a tough race, 2004 in Italy.
Well, it was probably quite a tough time to race in Italy.
Yeah. People often ask in those situations, one of the things that that I tried to get across in Rob Hales' book about just that feeling of being on the back and not being able to go forwards. Obviously, everyone's probably listening to that thinking, why didn't you just move up then?
Just, yeah, well, to the point whereby it's impossible. And, you know, so you try to move up a few times early on and you sort of move up, but then you just slip down. I think you actually described it in Rob's book. You move up and then it just suddenly you just slip down and slip down. And you find the only place that you can be without the stress of having, you know, 50 people behind you are going to yell at you and abuse you if you drop the wheel is at the back, so you end up sat there, which of course is the hardest place, but it literally feels like you can't move anywhere, but nor do you want to get off. So
brutal. I think that the worst thing I've seen was in Metz at the finish of the stage of the tour last year, 2012. It was chucking it down with rain, stage 7 perhaps. It was Saturday, I think.
It was a day before Planche des Belles-Filles.
It was, and everyone was a Friday. Nervous. Sorry, it was a Friday, the day before Planche des Belles-Filles, and there was a horrific crash, and basically the entire Garmin-Sharp team fell off. They were moving up together. Now, allegedly, Alessandro Petacchi was passing his overshoes to David Vigano, was it? The former Skyrider.
It had been raining, hadn't it?
Yeah, and he'd been 40, 50 k's ago, he was handing his overshoes to Vigano, and Vigano had his hands off the bars and touched wheels and lost control, fell down, and there were just bodies everywhere, and they were going so fast. David Miller said afterwards they were travelling at 78 kilometres an hour at the time, and it was just absolute carnage. And I was standing by the bus in Metz, the Garmin-Sharp bus, waiting for them to come back, because none of them had appeared yet. And when they arrived, they were like soldiers returning from the front line. They were in a right state. Van Summeren barely had any clothes left. They were hanging off him in rags.
Well, Dave Scar was incredible down his arm.
He had a terrible wound on his arm, and he said he hadn't even noticed that for 10 kilometres. He just saw blood dripping on handlebar tape. Christian Vandeveld was in an awful state. Tom Danielson and Ryder Hesjedal were both out of the race. They were even worse. And it was horrendous to see it. And Alan Piper, who's been going the tour for 30-odd years, came back and he looked traumatised. He said, I just don't know what we can expect out of this tour anymore. And it was genuinely quite moving and upsetting. And it was just this bleak, bleak scene. Rainy, grey, night was kind of closing in already. It was something like something out of The Road or something. You know, it was awful.
What was weird about that was in that post-stage kind of carnage where the media and the cameramen are running around and the photographers and the journalists and everyone's kind of crowding in around the team cars and the buses. It was also the day when Wiggins got hit by somebody's camera as a cameraman ran past and he called him an unmentionable four-letter word. And then that clip ended up on a Danish news site and it went viral and all of the rest of it. But there was something really weird around the Garmin-Sharp bus because everyone stood back. No one wanted to get too close to kind of, you know, what was, as you say, Rich, a pretty traumatic scene. Riders sort of, you know, sort of scooting in, sort of just...
It was the worst scene of devastation I've ever seen. And as you say, Lionel, normally reporters are waiting like vultures to descend on riders no matter what state they're in, but there was a sort of respectful distance kept that day. Christian Vandeveld stopped to speak, but it was awful. Anyway, Lionel, what's the hardest day or race you've ever witnessed?
I would say, just from the pure kind of epic black and white kind of nature of a race where you just didn't know what you were going to see next, would be the 2001 Paris-Roubaix, which started under a kind of slate grey sky and then the rain fell, and as a journalist travelling with a photographer, the beauty of Paris-Roubaix is that it runs from Compiègne up to Roubaix, and there's basically a motorway that goes parallel with the route, and the route actually crisscrosses it, and so there's plenty of opportunity to see the race, drive ahead, see it again, see it maybe 4, 5, 6 times before you get to the velodrome. And the first time we saw it was at the cobbles at Trois-Villes, which is the first section of cobbles after I think 150k, something like that, and we waited about 2/3 of the way along the cobbles, and it was just
it was like wacky races. Riders were skidding sideways, the cobbles were all slippery and muddy. People were sort of coming through at the, you know, after the main bulk of the bunch had gone through, cyclocross style, trying to run up the, up, you know, still thinking their race was alive. So they were doing everything to try and maybe get a wheel or get a replacement bike. And then we saw them the next time, and there were fewer of them, and they were muddier. And you know, there were some real shattered bodies coming through already. And then the next time we saw them, you could just see the whites of their eyes, or riders had put their sunglasses in their helmets, and so they were just kind of black masks with just eye, you know, their eyes were visible. And every time we saw them, it was like watching people fall apart, basically, until they got to the, we got to the velodrome, and Cervais Carnarvon, the Sky Director Sportif now, he won that race. But I'd never really, at that point, I'd not seen a race unfold in front of my eyes. And because you were seeing them every, whatever, every 40 minutes, the difference each time was so marked, so noticeable. Whereas on television, you don't get a sense of that because it kind of happening gradually in front of your eyes. Seeing them half an hour apart and just seeing basically a battle for survival. And that was the first time I watched a race, and I thought, why are you carrying on with this? Why don't you just get in the car? And that's when you realise, you know, the professional...
As a journalist, you mean?
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, I'd wanted to give up long before, but yeah, yeah. We pressed on. But, you know, going back to what Tom was saying about hanging on the back, you know, why do it? Well, you do it because that's what you're paid to do.
That's enjoyable. No, yeah, I mean, it was like people watching people fall apart. I think that's a very apt, very good description of bike racing. That's what we'll be watching over the next 3 weeks of the Vuelta, I suspect, with this year's course. We'll have to end it there, I think. We'll be back next week to discuss the first week of the Vuelta. Lionel, thank you very much.
Thank you, Richard.
Tom, thank you very much for joining us for the first time, and hopefully you'll be able to join us again.
Thanks, Rich.